The Shire of Nanap would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people of the Noongar Nation as the traditional custodians of the land of which this podcast is recorded on, and we extend our respect to the Elders past and present, and we extend that respect to all Aboriginal Australians living within the Shire of Nanap.
Put a really long fuse on it to make sure it could get right out of the way. The next minute we hear these three old boys coming down on the horse just up the track a little bit from there. And the next minute, boom, this damn thing went off. They were holding the horses back. They were in another camp. We sneaked over in the night, listened to them talking. And I thought, I don't know, he said, it's good to see these boys with a bit of spark, he said.
This is the Nanap Oral History Podcast. Today we're at the Supper Room Gallery talking with brothers John and Robert Dunnett. They share the long history of their family's farming life in Nanap, including horseback droving between Nanap and Scott River, and the challenges of developing isolated farmland, with a huge acknowledgement to both of their wives for making that commitment. The brothers also reflect on how the family business evolved over time, shifting from dairy to beef, then potatoes, and now branching into short-term accommodation and tourism. To help the listeners, can you please introduce yourselves?
Robert Dunnett.
And I'm John Dunnett.
Thank you so much for coming to join us. I know the Dunnetts have a long history in Nanap. Can you tell us about the family lineage and how you ended up here in Nanap?
Yes, all right. We'll go right back to when the Dunnetts came from Scotland, way back in the 1800s. And they first settled in Victoria. And then for some reason they gradually made their way westwards and they went to the Eyre Peninsula, had a big holding there. And then around 1907, travelled over to WA and he looked right around through WA for farmland so he could relocate.
When they first came to WA, he went to look at a station up around Meekatharra, and after looking at that, he didn't think much of WA, I think, so he was just about to take his family back home when he saw this place advertised down here.
He couldn't find anything that he fell in love with until he saw this property out on the Bailingup Road called Tanjanrup. It still is Tanjanrup. And he went down to have a look at that, so I heard, and decided to buy it. So then it gets a little bit more interesting because part of moving over here, he went back over there and drove a big mob of sheep all the way over the Nullarbor, which is incredible, I would have thought. And when he got about three quarters of the way over there, we've been told that there was a person, Talbot was his surname, and he wouldn't let them water. And he said that he wanted to buy them under his own terms. And the grandfather was forced to sell them.
He didn't have much choice then.
But the most amazing part, they became good friends later. How that happened, I don't know, because the grandfather was a bit of a traveller. He went all over the place and he was in a club in Perth and they became good friends. Father was born in 1908, was the first one in that family born at Tanjanrup, and they had 11 children in the family. Our grandmother was 15 years younger than the grandfather. That's probably how she had so many children, I think. And she worked all her life there. It was a lot of uncleared land. Tanjanrup was a much bigger holding then. And they cleared lots of it there just with the bullock teams and the axe and how it used to be. And they started, as all people did, with a dairy farm. Getting towards our time, my father got married in 1944, I think it was, John, roughly.
No, maybe it was a bit before because some of the kids were born during the war. He was away in the war.
Or in the 40s, early 40s. Married, and his wife was quite incredible. She came out of Perth because she was the Anglican Archbishop's daughter, and she came from Bishop's House down to the Bailingup Road, which is pretty remote back then. And they bought the property Quangup, which was much bigger than it is now, It was called Quongup, Q-U-O-N-G-U-P.
There still is a Quongup formation, but unfortunately the new owner, after we sold it, changed it to Hillbilly.
Okay, so that's where Hillbilly is now.
That's the one there.
So is that where you grew up?
Yeah, we both went to boarding school and we both left at 16, I think you did you, John? Were you 17? Yeah. 16, I was 16 in fourth year and farmed ever since.
We had a wonderful time there with boats in the river and fishing and marining in the river, doing whatever we liked around the place. Had to do jobs, milking the cows. Then you milked cows for butterfat, which is just the cream. You didn't. The milk went to the pigs. No one did the whole milking like they do nowadays. The Deans from Nunup used to come around to pick up the milk every twice a week, I think, probably,
yeah,
was it?
Twice a week.
Yeah. The old fridge system then, you put the cans of cream in this moat full of water, wasn't it, to keep it a bit cool for a few days and then send it off. Yeah. Actually, a few times when the flood came up, the fellow couldn't get through to get the cream, could he? And used to go either around the back or somehow we managed to be able to do it.
Actually, when we were young, still going to school, we used to love the floods. More came the better so we could get out of going to school. It was quite good, really. Another thing we did a lot of back then, before even going to school, I remember trapping rabbits and selling them for the rabbiter, we call him, down along the road. I remember a few times having such a bag full of rabbits, I couldn't lift them over the fence. I had to find a spot where I could drag them under and take them down there. We made quite good pocket money doing that.
5 shillings a pair, I think, wasn't it? You'd hang them over the gate. And
that was for the big ones of various sizes, weren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, a fellow from Greenbushes used to travel around, pick them up.
An old identity called Joss Sexton, he used to trap them and we used to go with him and we learned a lot of tricks about how you trap rabbits and up and down the hills.
Yeah, he was a real character, wasn't he? He had this old truck with a canvas back on that he used to camp in and he'd say, call it gutless, didn't he?
He did. And he had this big bushy mow and he'd smoke cigarettes and roll his own. It used to amaze me, he'd have a cigarette about that long and it'd be in amongst his mow and he was still able to light it without burning his mow off.
So did he used to come onto your property or everyone's property?
Wherever the rabbits were thickest, yeah.
Yeah, he trapped a lot on our property around there. Yeah.
He'd go out, set the traps, and he'd have heaps on the gate and we'd have a little tiny bit up the other end.
And he used to go to school on the bus?
Yes. Chesson Rowe was the driver always when I was there, I suppose when you were too, or what?
Most of the time she was. Unfortunately, I used to get really car sick. I still can, a bit motion sickness. Nearly every day I was sick going along that Bailing Up Road because it was a gravel road and so I feel sorry for her now. I had to pull her up probably nearly every day.
It had a bit of a smell, didn't it, the bus?
So tell us about coming back to Nunup and your journey farming as adults.
When I first left school, because my father had sold quite a bit, we only had 460 acres at Quongup. And then I managed to talk him into buying a property called Ellis's, which is opposite Doodinallop, as known now, belonging to the Brockmans, through there. And that was about another 600 acres. So then we had about another piece down opposite Tanjanrup too. So we had about 1,100 acres, but I realised it wasn't going to be enough for the two of us to farm eventually in 1957 when I was still going to boarding school. My father had put in for a conditional purchase block at the Scott River. So then we had that to develop. We did, and then we got into it and developed a fair bit of it with smaller machinery. And then about 1968, we bought a John Deere tractor, went up to the Royal Show and bought it there, swordless. And that was the biggest two-wheel drive tractors were then anywhere in the southwest at that stage.
Originally, when the old boys got Tanjana up, they got a bit of coastal grazing country on the coast. And the idea of that was just to take the cattle down there for 3 or 4 months and then bring them back again and drive them down the road. So we had that land there, like a lot of people did, had coastal runs just for that extra bit of feed.
That was one of the most important things, really, because that's why they went to the Scott River in the first place. The grandfather took it up as a freehold land back then, right, and it goes right into the coast, which is quite unusual. But back then, the hills were all so open and really nice grazing scrub on them.
Yeah. Well, a bit before our time, I remember the old boys saying they'd burn a bit of country here and there, and the cattle would run right up to Black Point or right down to Augusta, wherever they liked to go, and someone would just ride around, keep a bit of an eye on them and get them back when they could.
So it's sort of like the station country up north where it's not fenced. How long would that take?
Sort of 2 days from there to get to the Scott River.
We loved it, really, just doing that sort of thing. We did that before we left school, whenever we were allowed to go for a run to the Scott River any time. Driving the cattle was a highlight. We went from there, and when we left Tanjanrup, we went along and up Dunnet Road and right in next to the cemetery. Some of the cattle had wandered in amongst the cemetery back in those days and then back onto the road. And the cattle were quite amazing the way they'd go along. The leaders, as you call them, they could remember one year to the next where to go. They loved getting down there in the climate and the nice fresh tucker, I think.
Yeah, once they got going, a leader would usually get out in front and the rest would follow. So usually you didn't lose any, but occasionally we lost a few, but mostly they were pretty easy.
So I think it went to 1970, roughly, the last one. They got too many log trucks and traffic on the road and we will start to lose a couple. And it probably wasn't worth it as time went by.
Sometimes it was a lot of us just for fun, but often it was just two of us that went down there. Yeah.
Did you swag it? Where did you stay when you got there?
In my day and John's day, we did it what the old boys would call the easy way. Years before that, they used to put their swag on the horse and their tucker and everything and just go down there. But our father and Uncle Mel, as we called him, was David's father, they used to bring it along in the truck and meet us at Miliana Ford, which is Red Gully, you call it. And that was the night camp because the cattle could drink there. The government had fenced off areas. The only trouble with them, they used to get a bit carried away in the Nanup Hotel when they came around the corner. They'd say, I think we better stop and have one. And one would say, no, I think we should keep going. And the one would talk the other into stopping and blame the other one all the time. And this went on for years, didn't it?
I probably had a few too many because quite a few times we had to wait.
The time they got there, they were in a pretty good mood mostly, and they used to tell us some funny stories. We really loved it, especially when we were young kids. Told us things like, your age, you don't need a mattress, they'd say. Uncle Mel would say, I better take your mattress. We thought, all you need to do is scratch a bit of a hole for your hip, your age.
Yeah, he didn't take a mattress, but he usually ended up with the best one, didn't he?
Another time I think Mum had rolled up sheets in mine, yeah, which he would have. And Uncle Mel arrived and his had been rolled up without any sheets. So he pinched my sheets. He reckoned we didn't need sheets. We enjoyed the time with them. It was good fun.
How incredible.
Yeah.
I always remember that water at that halfway camp. If you had a bit of a wash or something, it was absolutely freezing, wasn't it, in that Miliana Brook?
It was, yeah. Sleeping under the stars was good fun.
And you would have known the route and the forest and all the land so well.
Yeah.
Really well. No trouble at all getting them there. The property itself was boundary fence where they went in our day, but earlier I think they used to let them run all out everywhere and just keep an eye on them now and then. But every year we took them down there, we had to go around the boundary fence and patch it up. And we also had to make a fence into the sea. And there was a spot where you could get out and run a wire out onto a steel peg that was put in the reef, stop them going along the beach. And if any people came, they didn't mind that. But in those days, you hardly saw anyone down there at all. Very rare that you'd see a track on the road.
If you did see one, the old boys would say, oh, that's Gordon's been along today or something like that, because you knew who it was by the track. Another time I remember Grant Aspie came with us, and he was a bloke from, well, he was around here, but then He went to Perth later, but because we used to drive us mad, the cars going through, that's why we gave it away partly in the end. So when the cars came, we'd argue about who was going to lead them through if they couldn't get through, because some people had no idea how to push them off the road and get through. And people were following, trying to get through the cattle for a long time, and then Grant said to this fellow, he said, "You've got no hope of getting through these cattle. You'll have to go back through Nana, back to Busselton, down to Margaret River and roll around to get past them." They weren't too happy about that.
I kept saying, "Any chance of getting through them? No, no, you've got to go all that way back." And at the last minute he weakened, didn't he? He said, "Yeah, oh, I better let you go through." But he would have gone right around. Going down with the cattle, we were told by our father and uncle about the water tree, which is fairly well known. We used to ride the horse up into that, and there was a fork in the Yarra and full of water there. You could scoop the water out.
All right. I know we did eat a lot of dust on the way.
Yeah, when we got out in the plains, it was windy. Yeah,
wasn't straight the wind was always straight up the road, so you got absolutely black.
Oh, another thing that is a bit funny is it was the three uncles, or two uncles. Uncle Vern was a bachelor. He'd arrived down there when we got them there because we had to split the cattle all into different groups. And I remember, not were you there that time? I was not long left school, really, I think, and I'd never heard my father swear in mixed company at all. And anyway, I hadn't heard him swear at all, actually. And then got down there and they were drafting the cattle and all the blokes together, the swearing that started up there as they were Carrigan amongst themselves. I couldn't believe my ears, really. So I started to learn a bit.
Yes, that was amazing. They'd swear down there, but they'd come back home and then it was different altogether.
Yeah.
A cousin of mine, one of the Thompsons, he was a bit of a wild fellow too, and he's a bit younger than me, a year or two younger, and I'd gone with my father plenty of times along the beach to catch some fish. But his preferred method of catching fish, we had a little leather bag on his saddle, and in there he had some gelignite, and he'd make up a small bit of gelignite like this with a short fuse on it. And if he saw a mob of fish, he'd chuck it out in the water. And I'd never seen him go in the water before. He didn't like swimming much, but he'd get in after those fish, no trouble. And he'd bring them out. And anyway, I learned a bit from how to do all this, and I must have only been, I think, about 13 years old. Probably. And anyway, Rodney, my cousin, was there, and we decided we'd get his little bag out, the three of them, Vern, Mel and Les, my father. They'd gone off for a ride up round the cattle, and we thought, oh, that'll be away long enough. So we got the gelignite out, and I set up a plug there with a full stick, if it was, with the detonator in there, and we put a really long fuse on it to make sure it could get right out of the way. And we ducked off, Rodney and myself, way back in the bush there. And while it was fizzling away to go off, the next minute we hear these three old boys coming down on the horse just up the track a little bit from there. And I was that frightened. I didn't want to yell out and warn them. I didn't know what to do, really. And in the end, did nothing. They were only about 100 metres away, and the next minute, boom, this damn thing went off. They were holding the horses back. It was really amusing. It wasn't so amusing later. I was in that much trouble. My father was thinking of ways of getting me back home to the Bailing Up Road. And I wanted to stop there for the rest of the time we were there. And anyway, Uncle Mel, he saw a different way of looking at it because we sneaked over. They were in another camp. We sneaked over in the night, listened to them talking. And Uncle Mel said, my father was saying how bad it was. And Uncle Mel said, "I don't know." He said, "It's good to see these boys with a bit of spark," he said.
Tell us about the land you acquired in Scott River.
We got another conditional purchase, just us two, in 68.
actually quite a few people said, oh, you won't get any more. And I said, well, one thing I know, you definitely won't get them if you don't try. So we did, and we managed to get another one, which was really good.
The government allocated land and you had to develop 10%. Someone used to come around every year to check that you'd fenced and pastured and everything.
We had to clear it, otherwise you couldn't keep it.
Quite a few blocks got taken back, didn't they, because people didn't do anything with them.
Now you can't clear one little thing at all. It's just turned completely 100%, one extreme to the other.
So did you do 10% a year?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the block was, well, that block was nearly 3,000 acres. And so we had to keep busy a bit. And we left Nanup eventually. It's nice, pretty country here, but it's a bit steep and everything, so it was a lot easier to farm down there, being flat.
In 1982, we bought the Versatile, I remember. It was a 330-horsepower full four-wheel drive tractor and big machinery. And that, again, was the biggest one in the southwest at that time. So we got a lot developed then.
Can you tell us about your wives and how they ended up in isolated Scott River?
First of all, I was invited to this party with a cousin of ours, Barbara Thompson, up at Steve's Hotel in Perth. And you were there too, John. There was a big party there and I spotted this. I thought she was a gorgeous-looking blonde girl. Been to the beach. She loved going to the beach, brown as they come. And I was over one side and I thought I better see if I can make a bit of an inroad into having a chat with her later. So as the night wore on, that's what happened, and one thing led to another. And she moved. She was a nurse and she moved to Bunbury Nursing and then to Bridgetown, and then we got married in 73. But the interesting thing is, in those days, for her to come out, she lived in Mill Point Road. Of course, the parents had to come down and see where we were going to live, and we were the first ones to live at the Scott River. I'm not too sure if anyone would have lived because no one was game to go down there in those days. In fact, all my closest friends and everyone reckon I'd gone mad making that decision. And it turned out to be a good one, but we decided to go there, and we were building the house, just picked out a spot. It was all bush when I took Diana down there. And then eventually her parents had to arrive, and I was very worried what they were going to think. And they came down this sandy track and all bush and not looking anything very flash. But the father was a real businessman. He could see the sense in it and he loved it. After a while he'd come down when we were doing shearing or anything to do with the cattle. He was a real businessman, so good with figures. He'd ask me how many baby beef we had there or something like that. He calculated all, oh, that'll be good for the bank, he said, and stuff like that. He had everything worked out and really enjoyed it. So I think I was lucky to have such a good mother and father-in-law, really. Otherwise, other people, you've got to understand, it's even the same now, that not many girls would live down there. Even her friends reckon she'd gone mad too when they came down back then, especially that was very remote then. We had no telephone, no power.
And what were the roads like?
Terrible, just sandy gravel. And when you got out onto the open plain country, from one year to the next, it'd wash out a bit here and there, and it just wasn't much of a track at all.
If it washed out somewhere, you just drove around and made it somewhere else. But they did make a straight, good, wide, sandy road. They informed it up a bit, so that helped a bit. But originally I remember sometimes stopping miles away from where we were, and we had to unload the horses there and ride down the rest of it in the winter because you couldn't get anywhere near it.
Yes, I think a lot of them did that, didn't they? Like the Lindsays too, just unloaded them up there. The first year when we got married, or we went for a honeymoon in New Zealand for 21 days, when we got back, the Scott River was getting quite high and we had all our presents that we'd got for the wedding and everything, and we're going along and we just managed to get through the water. We knew how deep we could get through it. We got over to the house that we'd only just built. By the next morning, the whole road had flooded across the top and taken a big section of road right out, stranded there for probably 2 or 3 months before
being newly married, I think you deliberately pushed the road out.
a lot of people reckon that it was a good excuse.
I had a camp there first that we lived in for a long time, and we had, there was no power first, but then we had a 32 volt system, didn't we? That actually it was the old one from Congup, and that we used to milk cows and for a bit of lighting. And I remember before you got married, we must have borrowed some money from the Commonwealth Bank, and the bank manager came out, and he was really good in those days, and he said, yeah, you can borrow the money we wanted, but he said, make sure you put a big amount into building a decent house, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right, living he like, did too.
Yeah. So that was probably a good thing. Yeah.
So someone would come out and build it, or did you build it yourselves? Or
no, we got a fellow from Busselton.
You had a job getting anyone to come down at all, because they didn't like that travelling in the old road and everything. And actually, only got two quotes. I got one from Alan Rook. He was a builder in Busselton, and another one, we went with him and he really enjoyed it. He went and caught some marron and camped down there all the time.
When he first came down, we must have said, where are you going to camp tonight? And he said, I should be right, I'll have the garage up. And he hadn't even started. We thought, how's he going to do that? But he did, didn't he?
Yeah, it was interesting, wasn't it?
I suppose I used to spend a fair bit of time with you and I as well before Barbara I met. She's from Nanup, one of the deans from here, but in the early, mid-70s, I went to church like people used to in those days and met Barbara there. And I remember saying to Rob Brookman, who's that girl over there? And he told me, and things snowballed from there. And we got married in 77, and the same sort of thing. It was pretty rough then. Actually, we first part of our marriage, we lived partly down the old camp because we couldn't get... Same thing, Alan Rook built our house, but he didn't get it finished in time for us to move in, so we spent a bit of time in the old camp and cooking down there. But I remember Terry McGregor lent us a big generator, a 1 kVA thing, and it was 10 times as big as they are now, but to run a few lights until we got the power on. When we got married, we got a second-hand Braemar hot water system. I don't know whether you know what that is, but it's a chip heater. You put wood in it and had hot water. That was second-hand then, and it's still going. It's still in our house down there in Karen Alley. Light the fire every day to get hot water.
Wow, that's fantastic. <Yeah. laughs>
Going back before we got married, when we camped in those old camps and went down there, and I was with my cousin David a lot of times, and you when you left school, and we had a great time there doing a bit of batching. And actually, back then I could cook. I've forgotten now. My wife's such a good cook, I don't bother anymore. I think it's better not to interfere. I might get in trouble.
A lot of our cooking used to be put a kangaroo tail in the pot before we went out to work, didn't we, on the old metters, and let it stoke her up with a bit of wood, and when we came in it was cooked. So.
We had a lot of kangaroo. I still like eating a bit when I get round to it.
So you'd catch your own kangaroo and...
Just shoot one now and then. Mm.
We did a bit of work with the neighbours, and we were making a fence out the back there, and we must have had the horses out there. And so one of us said, my horse is better than yours and that sort of thing. So Dennis and I had a race up the fire break in the middle of the night. And story was, someone said he won, but he's not here to argue. So, but I reckon I won. I think it's written in the book, actually, that I won the race. And Dennis said, well, let's make that the first meeting. It started the Woodabarup Cup, they called it, because their property was Woodabarup. They've kept it going ever since. So it's still a big thing. It had 700 people there this year, I think, raising heaps of money.
Yeah, back at the start, it was only supposed to be stock horses, but they've got a bit more fancy since, haven't they? John had quite a flighty horse. And I remember I won quite a bit of money on that because I knew it was pretty fast.
So you reckon it was pretty good. I'd go out and ride it and you'd make the money.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Our father, he used to be a judge of the horse races, and there was one racing one year, and he was standing at the finish line, and two of them flashed past. They were that close you couldn't tell which one won. And after great deliberation, he said, I think that one just won. Turned out later he had his money on that one too.
What's it raising money for?
Civilian Maimed and Limbless, they did call it. Now they've changed their name to spina bifida or something a little bit different, but it's basically the same thing.
So you've really been at Scott River since the beginning, because now it's so known for its farming and its...
Yeah, well, it was 5 years, it was a year you left school, John, that we stopped milking up at Quongup, and then we decided to go, because otherwise we had to convert the dairy into much higher standard to go to whole milk. So we went for beef cattle till 1982. We decided to run Merino Weathers, remember? The first shearing was in 1983. We built a new shearing shed down there, Merino Weathers and wool, because wool price was really good back then.
And the Weathers for shipping, got a fleece off them and sold them on the boat, which is going to be a thing of the past very soon by the look of it.
In 1989.
So what happened after that?
Went into beef cattle again and... the potatoes started to be the next thing, wouldn't it, John, I think?
That was really after we'd done most of the development, I suppose, and although some of the sites weren't clean enough for spuds even then, were they? So we had to do a fair bit of work and put centre pivots in and that sort of thing. So
that was a real busy time, just going back a bit with our development. We spent a lot of work on that. Because we only had a limited time of the year you could get it done, it'd get so boggy. But then we went for these potatoes because a friend of mine, Rod Lee, came along and he was a potato grower here in East Nunup. And he'd had a company called Simplot Australia from... they were based in... an American company, but they had a branch in Tasmania. And they wanted to start growing them at the Scott River because apparently there was lots of underground water, Yarragadee Aquifer. We didn't know much about that at all, but in the end, after a lot of negotiating, decided to give it a go and went into a sort of a share scheme with them where we got paid for doing the work and we leased out parts of our property for growing the potatoes, and altogether there were 600 acres. You had 200 on yours, didn't you, John, I think?
Mm.
200 on ours and 200 on Peter Horn's down the road, which is now Ross Woodhouse's. I think the last year was 2000, it was finished by 2000, because Rod warned them they needed to put in cool storage at manage them up, he said, otherwise they'll go rotten if you leave them in the ground too long because the rain will come. And they said, oh, yes, we'll do that. But of course, they never did, unfortunately, but they grew really well. Yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they, not knowing, they used to leave the Scott River ones until last, and often they got bogged because the grounds, because we were irrigating, the ground's sort of wet once the rain started. That was... getting bogged everywhere, so it was interesting. We had plenty of spuds to eat.
Yeah.
Beautiful, they were.
Yeah, I've heard Rob talk about it. It sounded like a very interesting time.
Next thing we were stuck with, and when we eventually got away from Simplot, we were stuck with all the pivots and the bores. So we thought we'd better do something with them, and we tried out-of-season bulk-up seeds like barley, wheat, canola. That's about it, I think. And also some hemp one year, wasn't it?
I remember our kids brought some kids home from school, from Bunbury grandmother went to, and this kid was amazed when he saw all the heads on this hemp stuff, even though it wasn't the toxic stuff. He cropped. He said, if I took this back to school, I'd make a fortune.
One of our sons, Andrew, had some mates from Manjum up there, and they were spotlighting roos, and he didn't tell them, and he thought they'd found marvellous stuff. They're in there trying to see what they could find.
Barbara and I went into growing grass-fed cattle, so we just grew pasture under the pivots and tried to have the natural cattle, which was pretty successful after we worked out how to do it properly. But trace elements and things were a problem, but once we got into the swing of it, and that was pretty good because we didn't... no grain in the cattle, we just had proper grass-fed, and we started selling them private to Dirty Clean Food, they call themselves nowadays. We supplied all their cattle for a while, but eventually we had to give it up, but it was pretty successful while we were going. Yeah.
This has been going until very, very recently, hasn't it?
Yes, not that long ago, yeah.
And eventually, in what year was it, John, we decided to sell? We decided for succession planning that we would sell all the north side of the Scott River, and John sold his. We split up our farming in the 80s, late 80s, and he sold his lot and we sold our lot about the same time, I think, on that side of the river, and we've kept all the original holding that the grandfather took up.
Yeah, well, we went at these tiny houses, we called it. We had someone in with it and we just leased the land and they built, or we put one and leased it now. And now it's amazing how popular it is just in the bush, people coming there pretty regularly. And our daughter is living in our old house with Ali and Karen, and they run the business now. And we've had a bit of work doing that, getting them in, putting them in place, and everything was a bit tricky, but they're nice spots now up on top of hills, and people come from far and wide and think it's marvellous to be out in the bush and isolation. And I think we've tried to keep it a bit quiet, but unfortunately now it's it can't help that. It's other people are enjoying it too now.
We preferred it how it used to be, for sure, but yeah. I can see the sense in it. Seems to be the way to go now. Seems to be a really big thing. Looks like it's not a flash in the pan. They seem to just come and come.
What's that called?
Little House Republic. Yeah.
Ah, that's you.
Yeah, fairly new, yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic. You've lived through a lot of changes in farming, hearing that you've gone from dairy to meat to sheep to potatoes. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us today. It's just been incredible. You've been listening to the Nanup Oral History Podcast. If you are not a Nanupian, please come and visit our small town. We would love you to come. If you are a Nanupian, please share it with your family and friends. We're really proud of this and we hope you are too.
This podcast was made possible through the successful funding by the Department of Community's Age Friendly Community Program, facilitated through the local government's professionals and supported by the Shire of Nanup. We would like to thank all of those who have shared their stories to make this podcast happen. The podcast has been produced by the Shire of Nanup's Economic and Community Development Team and edited by Simple Ben Stories.